Bibles to Leviticus chapter 23. So we continue the sermon series on the book of Leviticus. I'll just mention that if you would like to look at different translations of this chapter, I have a couple copies of a page of that next to the bulletins. You're welcome to grab a copy of that. Or if you would like to follow along with the words of the sermon, they should be available on the church website. If you click, go to the sermons tab and click there, you should be able to read along what I'm actually saying in the sermon. Meeting with God is a heavy subject. The C.S. Lewis begins, I think he approaches this matter in an interesting way in his adult science fiction trilogy. C.S. Lewis is maybe best known for his children's fantasy books, The Chronicles of Narnia, but he did write an adult science fiction space trilogy. And each one of these, the books in his space trilogy, there are meetings between humans and angelic beings. And the way he described these meetings has encouraged me to consider more deeply what does it mean for us to meet with God in time and space, if God is not limited by time and space. Think about that as I read a passage from the book Perelandra, a fictional account of an angel meeting with a human. Whenever the man looked straight at them, they appeared to be rushing toward him with enormous speed. Whenever his eyes took in the surroundings, he realized they were stationary. Now, this may have been due in part to the fact that their long and sparkling hair stood out straight behind them as if in a great wind. But if there were a wind, it was not made of air, for no petal in the flowers of the valley was shaken. They were not standing quite vertically in relation to the floor of the valley either. But the Eldils were vertical. It was the valley. It was the whole world of Perelandra that was aslant. And he remembered the words of Oyarsa long ago, "I am not here in the same way that you are here." And it was borne in upon him that these creatures were really moving, though not moving in relation to him. This planet, which inevitably seemed to him, while he was on it, an unmoving world, the world, in fact, was to them a thing moving through the heavens. And in relation to their own celestial frame of reference, they were rushing forward to keep abreast of his mountain valley. Had they stood still, they would have flashed past him too quickly for him to see, doubly dropped behind by the planet's spin on its own axis and by its onward march around the sun. It's hard for us to conceptualize God being outside of time and space. We crawl along this two-dimensional timeline at an unchanging pace, unable to go backward, unable to jump forward. And when we two humans meet, then we're intersecting on this same plane of time and space. But in order to make time holy and intersect with God, it means coinciding with a God for whom time and space is very different from our experience. And it's even an accommodation, I think, for God to talk with us about time, since it doesn't limit him. Probably not as important to him personally as it is to us. And yet he relates to us in ways that we can relate to. So what does it take for God to meet with us, this cavernous gulf between deity and humanity? Makes it no simple matter. But we know it takes holiness to meet with God. The second half of Leviticus has been about that, and we've explored a number of areas in the past months of holiness, diet, dress, family relationships, morality, leadership, culture, etc. And now in chapter 23, we come to the subject of making time holy. And once again, holiness is about being in relationship with God. It's not about what you do or don't do. So what I want to do is look at, oh, well, there was my quote from Perelandra. What I want to do is look at three key words in chapter 23, and as kind of an introduction to what are we talking about when we're talking about making time holy to intersect with God. And then we'll move on to looking at the kinds of Sabbaths that are described in this chapter and what the word Sabbath even means, and then try to come up with some applications for us today. Is it even relevant to us today? Two key Hebrew words are in the second verse of this chapter, the word mo'ed and the word mikra. The first word has to do with persons meeting and agreeing. And related to that would be the concept of the agreed upon time and place for that meeting. We've already seen many times the word mo'ed in the phrase of the Ohel Mo'ed, the tent of meeting, the tabernacle of meeting. In that phrase, the tent of meeting, the word meeting referred to a location where God would meet with his people. Now this word Mo'ed is going to refer to an appointed time that God will meet with his people. And the fact that these were feast days, many of them, is an added component. But this word seems to be describing a meeting with God. The second word is based on the Hebrew verb kara, to call. And it's translated as a convocation or a conference or an assembly that's been called together. And it's also the same verb is used when it says that the priests are to call together or proclaim this meeting. Those two words come from the same root. This second word seems to denote a meeting with God in the context of meeting with other people. It's a calling together of a bunch of people. The priests are appointed to do this work of calling the people together at times that would coincide with God's appointment so that God and man could meet together. Again, a function of the priest is to bring God and man together. The only previous mention in the Bible of this Hebrew word, mikra, was in Exodus 12, regarding the meetings on Saturday and Sunday of the first Passover holiday. Now, a third word that shows up here, or phrase even, is verse 3, the Shabbaton, the Sabbath of Sabbaths, or the rest of complete or solemn rest. This phrase was introduced at the end of Leviticus 16 in the instructions about the Day of Atonement. And we'll revisit that later on in chapter 23 here, maybe next week. The weekly Sabbaths are also introduced with this phrase in chapter 19. So here are three key words. Now I want to look at what they mean, especially this word rest, this Shabbat. What does it mean? The first time any form of this word Shabbat shows up, Sabbath, is Genesis 2:2. On the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had done, and he rested. There's the word Shabbat. He rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had done. It's describing God stopped doing something. He stopped the process of creating. And this Genesis passage puts Shabbat in parallel with the synonym kala, to call off, to quit, to cease, to make an end of the work that he had done. So, that's clearly the root meaning, is to stop doing something. Later on, we see the same word used to indicate that the seasons of the year would not cease, Genesis 8:22. Later, at the institution of the Passover, we see people should stop Shabbat, stop using leavening in their bread for a week, Exodus 12. And Leviticus 2:13, we see the command not to stop putting salt on the meat offerings, because that salt symbolized the everlasting covenant between God and his people. Again, stop Shabbat. And of course, it's in the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20:8 and following. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor the stranger that is within your gates. For I am God, and if I say you have to do it that way, you better obey it or else, right? Or else I'll smite you. Is that what it says? No. No. Notice the motivation God gives in the Ten Commandments is not based on obeying him because of his authority. It's there. I am the Lord your God. But the focus is about walking in relationship with him, following his example, imitating his character by joining and doing what he does, the way he does it, and therefore experiencing blessing. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. And a couple of chapters later, God adds a humanitarian reason in Exodus 23. 6 days you shall do your work, and on the seventh day you shall rest, in order that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female servant and the stranger may be refreshed. Rest and refreshment are a purpose for the Sabbath cessation of work. Now, going back to this phrase here, my mouse isn't showing up there. This Shabbat Shabbaton. The second word, Sabbaton, is basically a reduplication of the first word, so it could literally be rendered a cessation characterized by cessation, or perhaps better, a special time of rest above all other times of rest. It's used to describe the weekly day of rest, the Shabbat Shabbaton, in Exodus 31:15. It's used to describe the Passover holiday and the spring of the year in Exodus 16:23. And it's used to describe the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16 and the Feast of Booths in Leviticus 23, the fall festivals. And it's also used to refer to the sabbatical years, when people were to call off all of their farm work for 1 year out of every seven. That's in Leviticus 25. Thankfully, God gives us multiple times of rest throughout the week, and rests of different kinds too. When you're working hard doing sweaty labor and you stop for a drink of cool water, or if you're Amos, for a drink of kombucha, or when you get that quiet moment in the bathroom before stepping out into the office for the employees, or if you're a mom, for the kids to climb all over you, or that blessed moment when you can lay your head down on a pillow and fall asleep. In addition to these little Sabbaths, as it were, which they can themselves be times of connecting with God in prayer, God has given us these big Sabbaths, these Shabbaton, to rest from work for an extended time, a day, a week, even a year, and to meet with him and to meet with other believers in a special way. Now, I want to go back through these. I don't remember where. Okay, I guess I'll just stick right there. When were these three Sabbaths that are mentioned in the first half of chapter 23? First is the weekly day of rest. Then comes a brief description of the annual Passover festival in the spring, and then the annual First Fruits and Pentecost festival in the summer. And we'll get to the fall festivals in the second half of the chapter. And comparatively little space is taken up with the first two. I think because they've already been explained in depth in the book of Exodus. Leviticus is just a follow-up book. It actually begins with the word "and." It's just a follow-up to the book of Exodus. But these harvest-related festivals have not been described in depth, and so that's what is focused on here in Leviticus. As for the weekly Sabbath, verse 3 tells us it was to be a day of rest. And there was to be a time when the priests called together the people for a sacred meeting. That should sound familiar with our practice on Sundays. The Passover holiday, then, is outlined in verses 6 and 7, 7 days off of work, where they ate unleavened bread with their meals, and they offered a burnt offering every day, starting with a special meeting on the first day, ending with a special meeting on the seventh day. It would be perhaps the equivalent of some kind of a conference, a Bible conference or something, where you've got a week of where there's multiple meetings with other believers. You've got special worship stuff going on every day, and you're not doing your regular job. Then in verse 10, we have this third one that gets more in depth, First Fruits and Pentecost. And just to kind of summarize what was going on at this time, when the grain would first begin heading up in the fields, they were to cut and bundle a sheaf of grain stalks. And a sheaf would be about what would provide one person with a day's worth of food. And they'd deliver that sheaf, unprocessed, to the priest in the temple, along with two bags of bread and a quart of wine and a lamb. And then on a Sunday, not a Saturday, the priest was to offer the lamb and the bread and the wine burnt on the altar as an offering to God, and then take the sheaf of unprocessed grain and wave it in the direction of the tent of meeting. And then perhaps he gets to take that sheaf home for food, although other wave offerings had to be burned up. I'm not entirely clear on what was done with that sheaf later. But at any rate, God would accept this tribute to him and would consider the offerer acceptable to him. And from then on, the offerer could eat whatever grew in his field or garden, whether raw or cooked or processed. And then in verse 15 says, 50 days later then, when the crops are done growing and harvested, they would offer a grain offering from the new harvest. And by then, the farmers are going to know about how much he gathered in the harvest, so he can calculate 10% of that, give it as a tithe. There's this end of harvest first fruit offering that instead of an unprocessed sheaf of grain that comes from the beginning of harvest, there's a loaf of bread. The processing is already done. It's baked. It's the finished product offered at the end of the harvesting season as a first fruit offering. Now, by the time of the New Testament, the Jews had been overrun by Greeks and Romans and had become familiar with the Greek language. And in Greek, the word for 50 is pentakonta. So they called this holiday Pentecost in the New Testament. By the way, what day of the week was Pentecost? 50 days after a Saturday would be a Sunday. That's when they would have a holy convocation. Again, foreshadowing that Sunday when the Holy Spirit came as the first fruits of the inheritance to be received by those who trust in Jesus to make them right with God. I'm quoting Romans 8:23 when I say that. Pentecost was celebrated for a week, like Passover was. And over the course of the week, these harvest happy people with, they had harvested a lot of food, so they'd offer livestock as well. Every day, one perfect lamb on the altar, a couple of rams and a bull also as burnt offerings, and a sin offering of a goat, peace offerings of sheep. There was a lot of celebration going on, a lot of barbecuing going on. So these are the three Sabbaths mentioned in the first half of this chapter. We'll look at three more next week, Lord willing. But I want to move on to what does it all mean, and how does it apply to us, or does it even apply to us? Going into the meaning, as I mentioned, the word Sabbath means to stop, to cease. And so that's a central concept to this principle of the Sabbath is you need to stop, you need to rest. Verse 7 speaks of not doing any, as an adjective here, servile or laborious or regular or ordinary work on that day of rest. And since there is an adjective here, it makes me think that God's not outlawing all work in the physics sense of force times vector distance, but rather certain applications of force over distance. The Hebrew adjective is avda, which those familiar with Hebrew, avad, to be a servant, a slave. That's the kind of work that is being outlawed, is servile work. Of course, the priests were allowed to serve God. And that exact same word is used of what the priests did in the temple. They served God, avad, offered sacrifices and cleaned up messes and all kinds of stuff. And incidentally, that's one reason why we call what we do on Sunday morning a worship service, because together we are serving God through our worship. God's people served God on that day, but they're prohibited from serving anybody else or being served by anybody else. And I think that is a key concept. It reminds me of the Persian King Darius's decree back in the prophet Daniel's time when he said, "You may not pray to anyone except me on a certain day." You see the parallel there? God says you can't work for anyone or be served by anyone but me on a certain day. It's a statement of divine sovereignty to designate a day and say, "You may not serve anybody but me on that day." As we see from other scriptures, no slave was to be pressed into service to serve you on that day. That's explicitly prohibited in the fourth commandment. Case law and its interpretation by the biblical prophets also left it out of the question to harvest food. They couldn't harvest manna on the Sabbath day. Buying and selling goods was also clearly against this law. Nehemiah interpreted that way in Nehemiah 13. These are forms of service to gather food or to acquire it. to observe a day when we do not serve others, nor do we ask others to serve us in a contractual way, a servile way, is a way of saying God is our ultimate master. And we recognize and remember that fact. God is my master. He's the one that I serve. And so I'm going to take a day once a week to say, nobody serve me because I serve God. I'm not going to stand in the place of God and ask to be served. A second concept here that I'd like to bring out is that the ceasing from commercial service work was clearly related to meeting with God. There was a purpose for this cessation. It was not an end of itself to cease. It had a purpose. Notice how immediately it follows the calls for a holy conference throughout the chapter. Verse 3, a holy conference, you may not do any work. Verse 7, a holy conference for you all, do not do any service-related work. Verse 8, there shall be a holy conference, y'all may not do any service-related work. Verse 21, y'all must call together a holy conference on that same day. You may not do any service-related work. There's no ellipses. It's the two things are connected. There was a reason for not doing the work, and it was so that you could meet with God and his people. And so I believe that has continuing application to us. When we rest, the purpose, yes, the blessing does come to us, as Exodus 23 said, to be refreshed and rested. But there's a purpose in the rest, and that is to meet with God and his people. A third concept, a principle here, which we covered in some depth already when we looked at Leviticus chapter 2, so I won't cover it in as much depth this morning, is the meaning of the first fruits and the grain offerings, these harvest time offerings. What did they mean? And as I noted before, this was a form of tribute. It's a way of saying God owns me and my labor, and everything I possess was a gift from him. And I recognize that by paying him tribute. He's my king, and so I pay him tribute. I recognize the relationship that I have to him as his subject by paying a tribute to him. It means he's king. Proverbs 3:9, honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase. This is a way of honoring him, saying you're the king. Similarly, marking out time, tithing time, as it were, as holy to God, is a way to proclaim that God is Lord over time as well as matter. Okay, now we get to the million-dollar question. Does this have anything to do with us? Is the Sabbath principle still in operation today? And if so, to what extent? Consider these things. One is that the Sabbath pattern was instituted in the first week of creation. So it's not a new thing that was instituted in the Mosaic Law. Now, we may dismiss parts of the Mosaic Law as relating only to that time and place, but since it's not unique to the Mosaic Law, we can't be as dismissive about the Sabbath principle. Thing to consider is that resting one day in seven is framed in the Bible not so much in terms of obeying God's authority because he made a rule, but in terms of following God's example, saying this is what God does. Imitate him. Another thing to keep in mind, this principle of believers meeting together once a week with God is carried forward into the New Testament. Jesus met with his disciples before his crucifixion. He met with them on Saturdays, the Jewish Sabbath day. After his death and resurrection, every meeting recorded in the Bible between Jesus and his followers was on the first day of the week, what we call Sunday. Other languages call it the Lord's Day. I like that better. Gives him a little, Jesus a little more credit. The Apostle Paul also supported that shift when he instructed churches to meet. Instructed churches to meet and do their activities on the first day of the week, Sunday. Then in Leviticus 23, we see it's already been foreshadowed. We see God has hallowed the first, first he hallows the seventh day of the week, but then he hallows the first day of the week. Even in the Old Testament, there it wasn't a monolithic, only the seventh day. There was foreshadowing that there's going to be an eighth day that's going to be important in the days to come. It was shadowy back then. It wasn't real clear exactly what it would mean, but it's there if you look back at it. Furthermore, we see that when the apostle gives commands about how the church should assemble together regularly to confess their faith and listen to exhortations, he uses language from Leviticus. Assemble, assembly. All of this points to continuing relevance of the Sabbath rest and convocation principles in Leviticus 23 to us today. Maybe not in this exact same form, but in principle, yes. As I am running out of time, I'm not going to... There's so much that could be entered into now at this point, then. So how do we apply these principles? And that's one reason why I'm planning to take two Sundays to delve into this. There'll be hopefully plenty more to get into next week. But let me suggest some food for thought as you consider how to apply the principles of the Sabbath to your life today. The first half of Leviticus 23 describes these Saturday Sabbaths, Passover and Pentecost feasts, which included keeping track of new moons so that you'd know when the 14th or 15th day of the month was. The new moon was never actually commanded, but it was part of keeping that calendar system, and so it was valued. The principle of following God's pattern of rest is universal, but the details are called shadows in the New Testament and are said to have been replaced with more substantial things by Christ in Colossians 2:13. You who are dead in your trespasses and sins, and in the uncircumcision of your flesh, he is made alive together with him, having forgiven all your trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that stood against us and was opposed to us. He has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. And having disarmed the principalities and powers, he then made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in the cross. So let no one judge you in regard to food or drink or a new moon or a Sabbath day, which are a shadow of the things to come. But the substance is in Christ. Colossians 2 tells us some important things about how to apply what we see in the Old Testament about these Sabbaths. We see that there are principles, everlasting principles, shadowed there, and that Christ has instituted the substance of these things. So they didn't go away, but there has been a change in our relationship to them. And that change means no one can judge you in certain matters. I believe this means the Jews could not condemn the Christians for meeting with Christ on the Lord's Day instead of on Saturday like the Jews did, because the foreshadowings of God's atonement for man and the animal sacrifices on the seventh day after they've worked all week were replaced by the presence of the Son of God himself on the first day of the week to save them before they had done any work. Likewise, the festivals that were related to certain days after the new moon all foreshadowed things that Jesus did. Substitutionary atonement. A lamb killed instead of you. It was foreshadowed by what Jesus did. Jesus died on the cross instead of you. Prefigured by the Passover. The death angel passed over the firstborn. Because the blood of the lamb was offered. The offering of the first fruits on the eighth day. First fruits, sheaf waved on a Sunday, is fulfilled when Jesus' body was resurrected as the first fruits of the resurrection on the eighth day. A Sunday, first day. 1 Corinthians makes that explicit connection. That first fruit waving of the sheaf was a shadow of what Jesus did when he rose from the dead as the first fruits of the resurrection of the dead. There's the substance versus the shadow of the sheaf. So we're no longer bound to observe the events that were designed to foreshadow what Christ would do in the future, because now he's done them. Now we can observe the events memorializing what Christ did. That's what Jesus said, this do in remembrance of me. We look back now, using the new forms. Because the new forms are memorial instead of foreshadowing in their nature. Does that make sense? Sure, there are clearly commands to meet on the Lord's Day. In the New Testament, we see that's a clear pattern. The church gathered on the first day of the week. We see that there is some memorialization of that in the Lord's Supper. We see that as a clear ordinance that we practice. The observation of Resurrection Day could be another good application of that. There seems to be some celebration of that. Maybe not to the level that we do it in our culture, but there seems to be some observation and celebration, remembrance of, was it this day? Was it the Passover that Jesus died for our sins? Are there other occasions that we could observe too as holy days? Sure. Jesus participated in the Jewish feast days. He even participated in the ones that had been invented by humans and weren't commanded by God, like Hanukkah. Nobody, that might be something kind of like Christmas is, not commanded by God, but, if you want to use that as a way to worship God, make it holy, go for it. Nobody has the right to condemn anybody over observing or not observing those things which Christ has not commanded. Furthermore, when we come to the harvest language about first fruits, I don't know where I am in my, there we go. We see the words for first fruits and harvest used in the New Testament. But instead of talking about grain, it's talking about people. There has been another substantial shift. The substance is the people, not so much the grain. 1 Corinthians 15:20. Now Christ has been raised out of the dead, the first fruit of the ones who've been sleeping. And then jumping to verse 22, for as in Adam all die, So also in Christ, all will be made alive, yet each in his own rank, Christ the first fruit, then those who are Christ's during his visitation, then there's the end, and so forth. But this, there's a clear correlation between the first fruit is Jesus' resurrection from the dead. Then later on, we also see in Romans 16:5, its brother Epaphras that's the first fruits to Christ out of Achaia. 1 Corinthians 16 says the household of Stephanas was also a first fruit from the same province. It's now not the grain that the apostles are excited about being produced. It's new believers that they get excited about and that they celebrate as this is what God is doing now. God is gathering people to himself, and this is what we're going to celebrate. The New Testament church still brought money and goods to church to give to the Lord, but they also brought harvests and first fruits of new Christians into the church. So one application of the applications I'd like you to consider. Could you ask God to help you bring one non-Christian to faith in Jesus and bring them as a Christian into the church? That could be a New Testament application of the Old Testament shadow of bringing sheaves of grain into church. Could you trust God to give you one soul saved that you could bring into the church over the next year? Here's another challenging question. If the word Sabbath means cessation, and that cessation of work was for the purpose of getting together with God and his people, if that principle has not changed, even if the timing of it and all has changed, then what is it that you need to stop doing in order to set aside holy time to meet with God and his people? What is it that you need to stop? How are you going to get that Sabbath? Now, we recognize that there are some services that are necessary. You know, most of us live far enough away from church, you got to drive there. That driving could be considered a service, but it's necessary to get to church. We've got to need electricity in order to be able to, and gas in order to heat this building. There's some services that are going to be, disruptive if they're not continued. But there are others, which could be ceased, especially those which reflect our obligations to an employer or to a client. Do you have to require the services of a waiter or waitress? Or could you rest from that and give them the opportunity at least? They might not take the opportunity, but they could, at least your actions could give them the opportunity to be able to rest from that labor on the Lord's day, so they would not have to serve you. So that leads me to the next question is, how will you draw those lines between doing what's necessary on the Lord's day and resting and providing rest for others from service-related work? I believe that's part of our calling as New Testament Christians, is to find those lines and do them. That's how we set apart this day as holy. I'll stop there, I'd be happy if you had any kind of discussion you wanted to generate over email or whatever other forum over the coming week, as I kind of think about, okay, what am I going to talk about next week? I'd be happy to interact on these questions. But I encourage you to take the time to think through these things, because I think that as New Testament believers, these are the application points. How are you participating in the harvest of what God is doing at this time in history? And that is gathering some from every tribe and tongue and language to himself. And how are you going to, what do you need to stop in order to make time for to connect with God and his people? And how are you going to find that balance between not demanding that other people serve you on this particular day, and not offering to serve other people in order to set yourself apart as one who is under the authority of God himself, who serves God himself?